This episode of Hacks and Flacks was recorded at the end of October 2022. Liz Truss has just resigned as British Prime Minister after 44 days. Jeremy Hunt has stepped into the role as Chancellor of the Exchequer. And James Corden was banned from New York restaurant Balthazar after the owner stated the Star had treated staff there poorly.
Hello and welcome to Hacks and Flacks with me, Petri Hoskin. Hacks and Flacks is the only series where you'll get the inside scoop on how journalist hacks and the flacks of government and business work behind the scenes to decide which stories you'll be reading with your morning coffee, and perhaps more importantly, how they keep certain headlines off the front pages. What happens if a public figure is the subject of a salacious story? When does a scandal make or break a career? And how do you really know what is or isn't fake news? All these subjects and a whole lot more will be explored by me and a regular panel of hacks and flacks, ready to spill the beans and tell us how the sausages get made. Flacks like former government advisers Giles Kenningham.
Hello.
And Andrew McDougall.
Hello.
Plus hacks like Mick Booker.
Hello.
So now all the gang's here, let's delve into the world of hacks and flacks. Hello and welcome back to Hacks and Flacks with me, Petri Hoskin. I'm very excited about today's episode because we're talking scandal. Now, scandal is the ultimate form of gossip and can take many forms, often involving infidelity, drugs, or more recently being cancelled on social media. And even in these technological times, a juicy front page story can still shift those papers. As always, I'm not alone. And today I'm joined by regular panellist Mick Booker, who's editorial director of GB News and former editor of the Sunday Express. Welcome to the series, Mick. And also welcome back Giles Kenningham, who's a former political advisor. So without further ado, let's explore the anatomy of a scandal. Mick, not that I'm suggesting you're scandalous, but I'm sure you've presided over many a front page that was. How do you know when to release a scandal?
See, I was never a natural journalist and I've always had morals. Scruples, in fact.
But when that's no good. You can leave the room now.
But when I first came down to work for the Daily Star in 2001, everything was a scandal. Every single red top had a scandal on it every single day, seemingly. And I thought, how are we supposed to exist in this world? But luckily, the first time I'd ever had a splash, about a year before I joined the Star, was with the Daily Star as a freelance. And it was on the back of a brilliant scandal that happened up in the north of England. Remember when Jonathan Woodgate and Lee Bowyer, the Leeds United footballers, They had been out for a night out with a number of their mates. They ended up in a fight. It ended up with a young student, a lad called Safraz Najib, ending up in hospital. Now, I was working for a news agency in Leeds at the time, and we missed that story. So our bosses, very upset to see it on the front of the Nationals, and we obviously had to get something on it. We were, you know, reporters. We had five or six of us as reporters. We were sent out all over Leeds to try and track down what had happened, see what had happened. I ended up being stuck outside of Leeds General Infirmary for about 24 hours. And at that time, there was no name of any victim. We knew that there had been this attack. We'd known that the footballers had been arrested, but there'd been nothing of the victim. No one knew. So it was a race against time. You know, we weren't the Nationals at the time. We were just these freelancers knocking around. We were behind everyone else. So I just stood there all day, just approaching anyone who came out of the hospital. Then around about 5 o'clock. Now, we're getting to newspaper deadline time here for, you know, what's going to be the next day's splash. 5 o'clock, a young lad came out, and he was just a very, very angry young man who was the cousin of Safraz Najib.
Ah.
And this was, you know, probably about the 500th person I'd been up to that day walking out of the hospital. And he told me the whole story, told me the name of the victim. We rang the Daily Star, me and the photographer, who was also my boss, took some pictures of him. It was the splash the next day in the Daily Star, and we'd beaten everyone else to the name. So that's what I came down to London on the back of. That was one of my big scoops. But it was just, there is that thrill in the fact that it ends up, you know, you being that person who gets that name, gets that story, it's then the next day on a newsstand everywhere. It's one of the best feelings going, you know, and you do. Again, going back to the morals of it, you do sometimes forget that these are real people involved and there's proper human feelings involved. But at that moment, the journalism takes over and you just want to get the facts out there. And it's a great feeling when it's on the front page.
Giles, for you, you're on the opposite side of that coin. If you'd been advising those footballers that Mick is talking about, how would you have handled this?
Well, I think it was very difficult because I think both those footballers got convicted of a fray, I'm pretty sure. I think because you have legal proceedings, etc., live pretty quickly, I think it's quite difficult in those situations. It's more, don't say anything. And for them, it was all about the rehabilitation afterwards. How do they recover? And they, you know, are lucky that it really didn't, I would argue, haunt their careers afterwards. They both had pretty full professional lives of, as footballers. I'm not sure today whether you'd get away with doing something like that and recover.
That also led to one of the biggest cock-ups in Sunday newspapers.
Well, the Sunday Mirror.
The Sunday Mirror, then, the day before the jury was supposed to come back, they did an interview with the father of Sarfraz Najib, talking in very strong terms about what he thought of the footballers. Now, this was before a verdict. I think it was at Hull Crown
Court. Before a verdict. It collapsed.
Before a verdict, and then the trial collapsed, so they had to have a retrial as well. So they were very keen to get that story in, a little too keen.
And I think the editor, Colin Myler, had to resign.
He left soon afterwards.
That is huge, isn't it? But it always strikes me that there is. It seems like a double standard when it comes to things, not subjudice, but other facts that I can't use on radio or television that the newspapers seem to get away with, particularly
like
pre-Leveson. They do a headline like, nurse killed 14 children, inverted commas. Mm. In big letters, and then in smaller letters, say, prosecution in court. Mm. Now, I can't get away with doing that on radio, or as you know, Mick, now on television. You just can't get away with making a what looks like a statement and then justifying it two paragraphs down.
I think in terms of newspapers, and they're all very, very heavily legaled, and as you say, post-Leveson, it's incredibly scrutinised, even not just legally, but slightly more morally as well than when I first joined newspapers. But in terms of that court case and that sort of headline, and I think there's been one recently, as long as the copy backs it up and attributes it to the court and things like that, that's fine.
But you're selling it on the basis of this big headline that people go, oh, the nurse did it. And then they buy the paper and then they read down and it goes, you know, according to prosecution.
But I think people know how a newspaper works, don't they? And they know it's a narrative and you find out what happens. I think, you know, that's how you sell a newspaper as well, isn't it? But at the same time, people who read newspapers know what to expect. And so they realise that that's not necessarily... That's
not
the
sure,
prosecution
I'm
case
sure.
rather
I
than...
Always,
the...
I think post-Leveson, you've almost seen the death of the sex scandal. Mm. Now, when was the last time you saw a kiss and tell? When was the last time you saw a story about affair? Probably the Matt Hancock story, but that was because there was a very high public interest test in hypocrisy from someone who was in public office. But you don't, you know, open the Sun on Sunday now, which is, you know, probably the biggest selling tabloid, and see those kiss and tells, because the bar is so much higher now for papers post-Leveson because of privacy. So all these things are still going on. But I know, having worked with lawyers, that often a lot of this stuff can be kept out on privacy grounds. If there's no public interest and if there's no hypocrisy line, they won't run with it. You know, an MP could be having two girlfriends, say, but if he's not married and he's never preached on family values and there's no hypocrisy line, a lot of that stuff won't make it into the newspapers. A bit like now how newspapers can't just go on fishing expeditions and do voluntary sort of doorstepping on people, that doesn't happen. So you see, it's a lot, the sort of those salacious stories are quite rare now.
When I first came down and we started, I got put on the Daily Star Sunday and we launched the Daily Star Sunday, and we'd never worked, a lot of us, as it turns out in hindsight, we luckily never worked on Sunday newspapers and didn't know some of the practices that other rivals did. But when we started, we thought, well, we've got to have kiss and tells. You know, we were around the cheaper end of the market, so there weren't, you know, the biggest scandals in the world. But at that time, everything in the newspaper seemed to be a scandal, as I said before. So I remember there was a few times, particularly with girls who were quick to praise footballers and their prowess, shall we say. We usually didn't get any complaints on those because the footballers involved seem to think, well, I'm just good publicity, isn't it?
As long as you said that he was hung like a donkey, they were fine.
Indeed. But then later on, as you know, like, this was around about 2001, 2002, 2003, but as things moved along and then increasingly, as footballers stopped being the boys next door and they became these multimillionaires, they realised that, well, I've got this money knocking around, I've got lawyers now, I can pay for them. And that's the things started to cool a little then. And then every Sunday when I'd look at the rivals, we'd think, how are they getting those stories? Brilliant stories. And this was the mid-2000s. And as it turned out, some of them were doing it illegally with phone hacking and things like that. And every week there was a scandal. But on the back of that, papers like ours, slightly lower down the food chain, would then go door knocking on people involved in that, and we'd find the sub-scandal on the back of the scandal. And then these things just fed themselves. And then in 2 weeks' time, we'd see the News of the World have another scandal. So then we'd follow that up the next week. And that's, it just seemed to happen all the time. And it just created this just constant rolling bunch of scandals, which, you know, did well for us, did well for sales all around. And then it came to a grinding halt when it turned out that the biggest scandal of all was some journalists were phone hacking.
We'll get back to that at some point, but I do want to come back to you, Giles, on this bar that you mentioned. Interesting to the public or public interest. Mm. I get a lot of my friends who, because I'm a journalist, will say, well, how come that story's not in there? That's a really good story. You know, if there's a bit of Westminster gossip.
Yeah.
And I'll say, because it's not in the public interest to know that. And they go, well, how isn't it? Because, you know, things that Boris Johnson has done, parties that he's gone to, things like that, that don't seem to get the splash that a lot of the general public believe they deserve. Just how high is that bar now? Because it is interesting if somebody's got two girlfriends, even if they haven't voted on, because it says something about their character, doesn't it?
I think the bar is very high. Which is reflects in the fact, as I said, when was the last time
you
saw a proper sex scandal, in any of the nationals now?
Is it set too high, Mick?
I think there has been a massive recalibration since those days in the early 2000s. And I think a lot of journalists, we're doing it to ourselves as well. There is that fear in some newsrooms. You don't want to be the person holding the court. You don't want to be that person who shuts down a newspaper. And look what happened to the News of the World. The biggest surprise I've ever seen in a newspaper conference was at the Daily Express when we were all sat there in an afternoon conference. A reporter ran in and said, the News of the World is shutting down. And that was at the height of the hacking thing. And that is the big fear that people have, I'm sure, because, you know, when I first started, Twitter didn't exist. And it doesn't take long for people to go for advertisers, and it doesn't take long for people to then work themselves up in a moral outrage, and everyone joins in with the moral outrage. Whether Twitter or the rest of social media reflects society, I think we've realised that it actually doesn't particularly. Right. But that doesn't stop businesses and advertisers getting very, very scared by that. And as we saw, the ultimate thing was to shut down a newspaper. So that's where we were when the News of the World shut down. You mentioned The Sun on Sunday and why that they don't have those great stories, but they were born a few weeks after the News of the World. They replaced that.
Mm.
But, you know, they didn't have the resource in there. It was nowhere near like the News of the World. Newspapers don't have the resources anymore to actually look into stories properly a lot of the time, so that's not great. But at the same time, they were spooked.
But also things like stings can't happen so much now, can
they?
You can't do a sting. And obviously that's a classic tactic, wasn't it, of tabloid journalists? Put two pretty women in front of a celebrity and, hey, presto.
Or some money in front of Fergie.
Yeah, he falls victim to it. It's also interesting on scandals, I think, that often you see, having been on the other side, journalists get overcome with excitement of all these salacious details. And actually, half the time, the papers can't use a lot of the details because they are a quote-unquote family newspaper. I was on the other side of the Brooks Newmark scandal. And for listeners who don't know about that, that was the former Tory MP who got caught in an online sting where he exposed his crown jewels to a reporter from the Guido Fawkes website. And I know from having spoken to Guido Fawkes that they took this story to the Mirror, Sunday Mirror, obviously very anti-Tory paper, and the Mirror were always falling over themselves, couldn't believe their luck. They had this amazing scoop, which they then had decided they were going to unleash on the eve of Tory conference, and they paid Guido Fawkes a huge amount of money. But then it transpires. They can't print the picture of Brooks Newmark's crown jewels in the Sunday newspaper. They can't give all the salacious details. So I don't think, in fact, in the end, it actually sold any more copies, notwithstanding that we got tip-off that the story was coming at 2 p.m. and we briefed the story out ourselves to try and get ahead of the news cycle, because you get more and more stories at conference to try and kill it dead. So yeah, you have situations like that where actually, even though it on the surface looks like a great story, you can't use half the details.
This is the other thing I wanted to talk about, is the news cycle, which doesn't really exist anymore. Because if you've got a scandal, you've got to beat the person who might have it just on their mobile phone. So that's a problem for both you guys on both sides of the coin. Giles, how do you cope with something that you know could come out any second?
But I think this is a difference now, though, is that you've always got, when you have a scandal or crisis, you've got to think, what can I control?
Right? Yeah.
So now if you're a celebrity in the midst of a big crisis, you have your own platforms. So if you know a paper is about to turn you over on something, you can use your platform to get the full unvarnished truth out there before the paper does it. And that's a real shift. Notwithstanding that, you know, you have some of these celebrities or sports stars who have 4 million followers on Instagram. Mm. You know, the Sun's selling, what, a million, just under a million copies a day? You're going to reach more people anyway. I know when I've been in negotiations with newspapers, exploding the bomb around something, that, you know, you've always had, you know, if those conversations break down, you've always got in your back pocket, well, we'll just put it out on their platform.
It's interesting.
And you have that power, whereas you didn't have that like 10, 12 years ago. We go, no, actually, we'll just do it on our own terms. And that gives you that extra, card. And sometimes it is more effective just to use those platforms. It, you know, it will depend on your relationship with the paper and what else you've got going on with them.
You reach more people, but papers seem to have more credibility.
Yes, I agree that they did, but do they still have credibility?
I think, again, touching on both those points, there was one recently with, I think it was a Sunday Mirror, and they had a story about Ryland.
Yeah.
And there was a picture of him on the front page with a video of him, and it looked as though he was having a little bit of fun on a night out, I think. He doesn't look well. You know, they were making all those sort of nods and hints and things. The next day, when that paper hit the newsstand and a lot, when that front page was on Twitter, all of a sudden the sympathy was with Ryland. And it was the big bad newspaper. Why are you doing this to Ryland? This isn't cool. You shouldn't be doing this. And straight away, the narrative was that the newspaper's bad, Ryland good, leave him alone, don't do that again. And then I think that's increasingly happened. The sympathy is with the person who is featured in the newspaper.
But as an old newspaper man, I don't mean old, as in ancient, where you are a bit. But, you know, there can't be anything worse than a second-hand scandal or a second-hand splash, if you like. How do you beat modern technology? How do you make sure that you've printed something on the front page that just hours before hasn't been seen on Instagram?
I think the thing with newspaper readers is they want that, and I think these days as well, we see them as they're in your club. So if something's slightly out of date, I don't think they actually mind that much, as long as they've got that digest of the news. The journalist in you wants to be the first, obviously, and you want to be the one who beats all the rivals to it. But if it's, I think newspaper readers are very different to the people who look at stuff online. And I think newspapers can still get away with that. I mean, there's always ways of refreshing a story.
Giles, if I can come to you and talk to you about political scandals specifically, it's almost head spinning at the moment. When it's like this, when it's like a machine gun as opposed to a sniper with scandals, do people like you just give up and go, look, let's just let this run its course? Because there's so much, it seems at the moment, battering the public about how, you know, terrible MPs are, or about, you know, how badly behaved they are, or about, you know, potential fighting just outside the Commons. I mean, it's all a bit much, isn't it?
I think with these situations, it's always about get everything out at once, get the full disclosure, dump it all out. Yeah,
good day to bury bad news.
Don't try and
you must have covered up loads of stuff.
Most of it was just trying to beat the news cycle. Like on the eve of Tory conference in 2014, so last conference before the election, on the same day we had the Brooks Newmark Crown Jewels Gate scandal, And we had Mark Reckless, who's a Tory MP, defect to UKIP, which was a real issue for us, all great within name. The space of half...
Yeah, great name.
It, all within the space of half an hour. And all we did at that point was, as I said, we just dumped all the news out. We tried to spike the Newmark story to go early because you have a faster news
cycle.
So in
news, you mean you dump manifesto promises or all the bad news?
We just dumped all the bad news out. We actually proactively briefed the Mirror story out for them early, just to be kind, to get it out there on our, at least, you know, because it's like, once again, what can you control? We need to get this out of the way so it doesn't overshadow conference, in the hope that we've got other announcements, which then take over. So you say, what is the big ticket thing which is going to move the news agenda along? But also with the Brooks Newmark story, the thing which helped us is that it was a newspaper story, right? Although it lent itself to a bit of commentary on TV, there's only so much you can say because, yes, once true. Again, the editorial...
It's almost a perfect scandal, isn't it?
You can't do much. It's a perfect scandal to handle because there wasn't loads of detail they go into. He resigned straight away. So then the only thing you're worrying about is like, right, is there anything else to come out? Do we have other scandals? But nothing else happened. So it kind of ran its natural course, I would say, partly because of Tory conference, a little bit quicker, probably.
What about other salacious stories that may not have made the biggest splash that you've seen? There was one about a rent boy, wasn't there?
There was a Conservative MP who got... caught with an escort, and he decided to take the escort onto the parliamentary estate and then onto the parliamentary terrace. And when we informed the Whip's office of this, they said, well, you don't actually know the full story, by which time the story was about to kick off. They said, actually, when he took the rent boy escort out onto the parliamentary estate, a fight broke out because another MP thought they had an exclusive deal with this rent boy. That story never made it out into the public arena.
But that is in the public interest, isn't it?
These things are pretty hard to prove and get in a newspaper.
Right.
And even back then, there were.
With that story, the issue was that they'd also taken drugs together, and the Tory Association cared more about the drug taking than the actual gay sex. That issue was like so. But your point, yes, there are stories which don't come out. I suppose the public do like scandal and gossip. But then Boris Johnson is quite an interesting case study, where people go, yeah, I don't care about his private life.
Yeah, what is this Boris Johnson effect?
It's him and Trump. There's something about them. They're Teflon. They get away with it. People don't care. I suppose people and Boris Johnson supporters will argue, well, look, he's never preached about family values. He's never discussed his private life. So he's entitled to it. Those guys, you know, they get away with it because they're also larger than life characters, but they wear it quite easily. Boris just lets stuff kind of fall off him in a way that you'd see someone like Theresa May be completely haunted by this. I remember seeing Boris at Tory party conference in way back in 2006, where he made like 4 gaffes in a day, and there was this huge media scrum outside the press room waiting for him. He was busy writing, I think, his Spectator or Telegraph column, so it just got bigger and bigger, and journalists were trying to climb up on ladders over it, and, you know, because it had been quite a slow news cycle, so other politicians would have been absolutely haunted by that. Boris just walks out into this huge scrum and is reveling in it. It's like, I don't know what the big fuss is about. But you can see him smiling in a way that, you know, someone like Theresa May, like I said, would have been absolutely haunted by that. Other politicians would have thought, oh, it's the end of my career. So there is something about actually owning things and going with it, which means you can get away with
them. Some might say that's slightly psychopathic to not really...
Well, we had a tricky moment with him when he was... It was the first time around when he was trying to be leader, and there was that... Remember when The Guardian on the Friday night had that story about there being a bit of a dust-up with his and Carrie's house?
Oh, yes.
And I think wine had been spilled and things like that. So I was on the Sunday Express. Obviously, we following that up on the Saturday for the Sunday newspaper. I think he was giving a speech somewhere in Middle England, and he came on stage. He styled it out. It wasn't mentioned at all. Our front page splash, I think it was something like, just tell us the truth, Boris, because his people wouldn't say a word about it. No one was saying a word. So we thought, well, let's see. I mean, we're pretty much in the Sunday Express on the side of Tory voters, things like that. But they wanted to know the truth. What had happened? Why were the police called? His people at the time weren't very happy at all. And again, there's that playoff because it's these days we kind of rely on them for certain information, and if you get to that point that if you annoy Boris, if you annoy his people, particularly people, you know, people like yourself looking after politicians, are you going to come back to me next week with a great story and say, hey, look at this great policy, we'll give it to you exclusive? We worry that we might not. So there is that payoff. So if we criticize this person, are they going to come back next week and not speak to us anymore?
Yeah, but surely that's the job of journalists.
Well, it is. And that is why we went for it, because at the end of the day, we have to do that. We have to. Exactly. But these days, there is that slight...
I think it comes down to under-resourcing.
Under-resources and newspapers.
Papers don't have so many resources now, so they are more reliant on that drip-drip feed of news, saying politics coming out the door. You know,
but that's politicians controlling
But I'm saying part of this is down to... The decline in traditional media, whereby a lot of the newspapers used to have 6 political correspondents. Mm. They now have 3 or 2 who've got to file on multiple platforms throughout the day. They don't have time to scrutinise the story in so much depth, to dissect it, to go off diary, which is why, to Mick's point, they're more reliant on the access or the feeding of news stories in a way that I would have said 15 years ago, they were less reliant.
That's it. I know.
Does that worry you, Mick, though?
Oh, it does. But you've got to get a newspaper out at the end of the day.
Let's talk about scandals that destroy people, and maybe scandals that weren't true or had a modicum of truth in them or disproportionately destroy people's lives. Has that happened in politics that you can think of?
I mean, I can think of scandals which have finished people off completely. I can think of scandals more in the showbiz world which haven't necessarily been proven. You know, in the showbiz world, you've had John Leslie.
Completely destroyed.
Completely destroyed over sexual allegations. I don't think Michael Barrymore has ever recovered from the guy, Stuart Lubbock, who was very sadly found dead in his pool. To this day, his showbiz career is pretty much, it's over. In the political space, definitely have seen scandals which have finished people off, but I think often they've been pretty cut and dry. I don't think in this country perhaps we believe, or it's, you know, in America you've got to have a scandal, right? It's like a rite of passage. It is harder, it would seem, to come back. You know, everyone loves the sort of rehabilitation, the sort of great turnaround, sort of, you know, I found God sort of stories. You know, like every US politician is expected to have a sex scandal. Look at Bill Clinton. I mean, look at Trump.
That was one of the best, though, wasn't it?
Trump. I mean, even there was the governor of New York who got caught, I think, with prostitutes. I think he might have survived until, like, more stuff came out. Like, you can get rid of Anthony Weiner, the congressman.
Great name.
He was married to Hillary Clinton's deputy chief of staff. You know, he had one scandal, and then he was running to be mayor of New York, and he was in the lead until another scandal then came out here. But I think here, if you get hit by a sex scandal in politics, it's pretty hard, and minus Boris Johnson. Yeah, it's pretty hard, minus Boris Johnson, for people to come back.
It's also difficult sometimes for a celebrity, isn't it? Hugh Grant, Mick, comes to mind with the Divine Brown story, which just doesn't go away. I mean, there were images of a Divine Brown in the papers recently, and it all goes back
to... It didn't help that it was a brilliant picture, the mugshot, does it? And that mugshot coming out all the time. I remember that time, it was before I think it was just before I became a journalist, and I remember reading every line of it. And there was the Sunday Mirror, there was long lens pictures in, I think it was Liz Hurley's then girlfriend's back garden, and there was him and they were sat on a bench together, and he was clearly so ashamed of what he'd done, and it was that very difficult conversation that you're having with a very difficult conversation with your girlfriend as to why you were on Sunset Boulevard with Divine Brown, and there was that picture of you and with a mugshot. But then Hugh Grant then subsequently becomes the man who backs Hacked Off and the man who goes for newspapers, and he's clearly never forgotten what he was put through as a result of it.
But did he deserve to be put through that? Like you said, was that really in the public interest as opposed to interesting to the public? Like you said, and both of you have said, it helps that there were those photographs.
I think it would have always, even in this day and age, that story would have come out because it's in America, right?
Yeah.
So it's a lot easier to get stories out in America, right? The sort of...
And once it's been out in America, you can do it in the UK?
Not necessarily, no. I mean, I can think of one celebrity couple who've got a high court injunction out in relation to their private lives, but it's been, I think, in the National Enquirer in the States. So no, it doesn't. I mean, obviously the internet makes it a lot more difficult to control things now. But
I think Hugh Grant had it was the misfortune to do that Well, it was at the absolute height of his fame, wasn't it? It was, you know, Four Winds and a Funeral. He'd come off at the back of that.
And basically, those who can't remember is Hugh Grant was caught in a car with a prostitute called Divine Brown, allegedly giving him a blowjob.
Yeah.
But I don't think it harmed his career. I mean, that incident happened 1994, 1995, I think. So that's like, what, 27 years ago. It done really well. It's been in loads of films. I don't think.
But I can see from.
Think it's been a defining episode for him in a way that other people have been.
But I think he's got the grudge.
He's got like a chip on his shoulder about it.
Going back to what I said at the start of this, I always had that feeling of being slightly moral and thinking, I wouldn't like this being me.
Yeah.
And so I've always had that sense of morals about story and whether it's the right thing to do to publish it. And I think as my career's gone on, I've fitted more in with how newspapers are now, whereas at the start...
You've had to sell your soul.
No, I'm not selling my soul, but I think newspaper editors now have to have that moral compass that they'd necessarily... Particularly on the red tops in the 80s, 90s and early noughties, I think they didn't really have that. It was that idea. Newsrooms were very competitive. Everyone wanted the best story. People were switching off people's computers, stealing notebooks. People were doing this to try and put off their rivals in a newsroom. So that's why you had that atmosphere in certain newspapers, like the News of the World and like other ones at the time, where they had to get the best story and they didn't care about the collateral damage. And there was that atmosphere kind of still lingering around Fleet Street when I first joined it, but it was going away because a lot of those big old beasts were, they went the way of most of the big old beasts in Fleet Street. They had massive heart attacks or got a drink problem or whatever it is, one affair too many or set fire themselves in the toilet or something like that. It was that sort of environment, but that's changed now. And I think as we were coming towards the Leveson, anyway, I think that the morals were changing anyway. And I think society's morals were towards that sort of story had changed as well. But it all just came at the same time.
But they still want to know. Just very briefly, who do we think has been the best at reinvention after a scandal? I mean, I'm thinking, Cheryl Cole, who is the nation's sweetheart, the Geordie gorgeous girl, who was done for being really aggressive and racist.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing how people don't remember that. I think if that happened now, also because...
She'd be cancelled.
Also because social media would have allowed it to have got such a wider audience. Yeah. You know, her sponsors to Mixed Point would have dropped her, just like that. I don't think she would have survived. Because what she did was a career-ending thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be a career-ending thing for many people, even if they weren't a celebrity.
To go into a bathroom at a club and...
racially assault a worker in there. And somehow people, she's been on obviously Saturday primetime TV. She's almost like a national treasure. People don't remember that. But I think part of that is due to the fact that it wasn't the age of social media. Yeah. Otherwise, she would have been canned.
We were. I think I was news editor on the Daily Star Sunday that day because it happened on a Friday night, and obviously then we'd heard about it on the Saturday morning. We were trying to get the victim. Trying to get anyone who'd been in the club. And I remember it particularly because at the time we were doing our usual thing of trying to force a story about Ulrika Johnson getting married again. And luckily, the Girls Aloud star being accused of racially abusing someone in a club overtook that because it was actually a real story. So that always helped out. But you do forget about that. But I think social media did change absolutely everything. One of the best, again, it's... The moral compass may have gone a little bit, but I remember one of the best feelings of walking in the Daily Star Sunday one morning. I turned on the internet, I think it was TMZ, the pictures of Britney Spears when she'd shaved off all her hair.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, holy cow, Britney Spears has shaved her head. And then it was a scrabble to actually buy those pictures. The News of the World tried to buy them entirely off the market. Again, this was before social media actually took... So most people in the world hadn't actually seen those pictures by the Sunday morning. Luckily, we managed to cut a deal and get some of the pictures. That was... Wow!
What sort of money did you pay for?
I think we would have ended up being about 20,000 just for... to actually get those pictures... I mean, that was quite cheap for them.
You wouldn't get anywhere near that. No. Selling a splash now, you might get 10,000.
But that was the cheaper end. That was the cheaper end.
Is that right? Anywhere.
Yeah, because in a way that... So how long's an exclusive for? Someone rip it off. I think... with some stories they may hold them back to the last edition, but within 2 minutes it's been ripped off and it's been put on the Mail online. Mick, I wanted to ask you a question. What's the biggest scandal you never published? that you can say within the confines. It's just between the three of us and the confines of this room. No one else. This is a family podcast as well, remember.
It absolutely isn't.
There was a football manager who may or may not have been had a TV star gay lover at the time. I seem to remember that one.
TV star gay lover.
Yeah. That we didn't get around to publishing, but we were fairly certain of.
What about the pop star in the video? The way I remember you telling it to me, this pop star who we won't name has a jilted girlfriend. This pop star is going to chat rooms looking to pick up other women. This jilted girlfriend goes into the chat room posing as someone else and catches him in his birthday suit, pleasing himself. I think the way Mick told me...
I've still got her number in the...
Daily Star said it had the video. And I remember asking Mick, I was like, so why didn't you run with the story? Was it on privacy grounds? He goes, oh, no. This is where this lawyer deserves every last penny he got. They kept the story out on copyright grounds because they said, well, this pop star, he's the main star of this video. And therefore, you know, it's worth £1 million. So if you want it, you're going to pay £1 million. And because a pop star was well known, you could claim that actually was the case. It's never been used.
Brilliant. I have seen, I've just now, now you've reminded me of that, I have seen a lot of pictures of men's bits in various forms of arousal over the years, which luckily haven't ended up in the newspaper. Not so many women do that,
of course.
Interestingly
they don't.
Enough, no. You know, whereas the man, they're very keen.
They're very keen
to show it off.
But I mean, now half this stuff just ends up on social media, doesn't it? When you see footballers who've been caught, you know, sending pictures, and someone will post it.
What about
online.
The comedian Joel Dommett?
But he uses that as a sub story now, doesn't he?
He does now.
He claims
he's a victim.
That the fact that he was catfished, wasn't he? Catfished into flashing it out.
And he survived.
And
he's
survived. He's now the Masked Singer.
Yeah.
It would have been the Masked
Singer. Just look at what the headline is now. Yeah.
Right, guys, let's just move on. You're in bed.
Yeah.
Whether you're naked or not is entirely up to you. And what you're doing with your tackle is entirely up to you as well. It's 3 a.m. The phone rings. And it's a call you've been dreading. I'll start with you, Giles. What do? You get a call, somebody's in big trouble.
Yeah, I mean, normally, I don't think I ever had a 3 a.m. call. The calls which I would dread when I worked in Number 10 was a call at 2 p.m. on a Saturday afternoon, because that would normally mean someone was calling, and it'd normally be for the Mail on Sunday or the Sun on Sunday, and I'd be like, oh, shit.
They've got something
huge, because that was kind of the latest they could probably call you, because they've got to give you due time to respond and to actually check out the story, and you'd kind of think, now my next 2 days are going to be ruined, because it's probably going to be the splash, and then it's going to be leading the broadcast bulletins. I think with these things, it's always, as I said, what can you control? It's either you only know what you know, so it's getting all the facts. Then it's like, do I want to get the story out first? Do we want to try and shape the story around a mea culpa? So the story is more about the apology than the actual, you know, the actual scandal at the time. Where can this scandal go? Are there more people who are going to come out? And what other news stories do I have in my back pocket to try and move the news agenda on? I mean, I wouldn't say this was a huge scandal, but one of the cleanest political resignations I saw was Mark Harper, who was at the time the immigration minister, and had not just inadvertently, but he'd been duped. His cleaner had shown him her papers that she could work in this country, and I think also a passport. So he had checked out, he'd done his due diligence, but nonetheless, she had duped him and he was immigration minister. So there was a good case for him not resigning and surviving and styling it out. But in the end, collectively, I think, and he was, goodness, he just resigned. And he was back in government within 4 months. And it was a clean kind of way of doing stuff. Yeah. And he just took the hit and he came back and is, you know, I think, you know, unblemished by that.
Extraordinary.
Extraordinary. But it's always a case of, you know, these resignations of, you know, when people are in trouble, it just gets so much worse the more they hang on. Germany.
Some people.
Although I remember David Cameron had quite an interesting take on it. He said that often, sometimes when these things erupt, because you know there'll be a feeding frenzy at the start, right? And sometimes it's not as clear cut as the way the papers like to sort of present it. And he would always give the ministers the benefit of the doubt, and actually he would hold on to the ministers probably longer then they should be held onto. But therefore, they would feel there'd been a sense of natural justice. He'd given them a fair hearing. And often those ministers would come to him and go, look, do you know what? Actually, I think I should go. They would then go back to the back benches, but he kind of had their loyalty for standing by them, as opposed to you've seen other prime ministers just freak out at the first sign of trouble. I throw them under the bus. Then you have people on the back benches who hold a grudge.
Don't mention Liz Truss at this point. Mick, if I can come to you on this, you're now editorial director of GB News, which is television, right? So this is rolling in a sense. It's just programme after programme live. What do you do if something's gone wrong?
I think I've learned not to panic in newspapers for doing it for so long. Again, somewhere like GB News, I'm one of the more mature people in the room as well. So if something goes wrong, there may be some other people around who are a bit younger, a little bit experienced, and, you know, you could see why they would panic. Not that I've seen much of that at GB News anyway, and we, you know, things have moved on a lot since launch, and, you know, fewer things go wrong, but, you know, everything goes, things can go wrong anyway.
Well, there's Ofcom, isn't there? I mean,
but
the
in terms of
beast.
In terms of Ofcom, you know, we do everything we can to be compliant with everything. We, you know, GB News could have launched as an online entity and avoided that, but we deliberately launched and be Ofcom regulated. And, you know, there is a sense of when you go from newspapers to television that there seems to be tighter rules. But again, I think a lot of journalists have now got a stronger moral code in that way anyway, and are a bit more cautious, particularly over things that could be...
Well, you can get your licence taken away.
Well, exactly. And as I say, it goes with newspapers. You can get yourself shut down by a Twitter storm, but I think that could still happen to a TV channel as well in these febrile times, as we keep on being told. I always just try and use common sense. And I think, as one of my old editors said, if in doubt, check it out. If in doubt still, leave it out. And I think that's what I tell people, and I think that's a good code to live by in journalism.
Let's have a look at the PR cock-up award of the week. But there have been so many few days. James Corden, Liz Truss, everybody.
The entire Conservative
stiff competition.
Yeah.
Mine would be James Corden with this so-called omelette gate, where he screamed at the staff at his New York restaurant, I think on a couple of occasions, because they slightly got his food order wrong, didn't cover himself in glory. And interestingly, you know, this is a story which first came out on social media. I think the restaurant owner posted what happened on Instagram and it blew up. And I think subsequently, I think Corden has apologised after the event, but then it got brought up in an interview. I've seen he was moaning about the fact it's been brought up. So even now, isn't showing a sense of contrition.
No, he said
he got caught, basically.
Yeah, that's what
it
feels like.
And this is actually interesting, because this is in the age of social media. I always think, like, when people are doing that, you are such a fucking idiot, because what are the chances someone's on a camera phone
around
the corner just filming you? And I was always surprised in politics that there were certain individuals who had a short temper who weren't caught when they were out and about in public bawling people out on a camera phone, because everyone is a citizen journalist now.
The MP that called a police officer a pleb?
Andrew Mitchell. Yeah. He did or he didn't, and he said he didn't. But he ended up in court. But I mean, Corden, I suppose he's so big, it isn't fatal, but I mean, it does go to the heart. It doesn't reflect well on him at all. It's just like, you know,
it's awful. It's an awful thing.
Yeah. And as a celebrity, you know, you're almost a high profile person, you have almost a responsibility to act. You know,
I agree.
There have been rumors for a few years, haven't there?
But there was also the fact that he was asked, I think, by Jimmy Kimmel, I think, to name a cameraman on his own studio floor, and he couldn't name one. Which is disgusting.
Which says a lot as well, doesn't it?
It says a lot about
him. He's been a regular on Pot Bitch, hasn't he, over the years, to certain things that he's been accused of. But I was surprised, because he actually faced this one. So it must have been banged to rights on this one, to actually comment in any shape or form.
What was he called? A tiny little cretin of a man? Which I think is one of the greatest lines I've read in a long time. Mick, for you, what's your PR cock-up of the week?
Well, as I said, in terms of what we've seen playing out over the last week, the Conservative government has been the biggest PR cock-up of the entire week.
It's an ongoing one, though. You can't see it in isolation.
But what we've seen is that there doesn't seem to be anyone doing what your job used to be in there.
No,
properly.
I've said that. There doesn't seem to be any advisors.
And if they are, they're not making themselves known to people like me. They're not making themselves known to people in newspapers particularly well. And I think part of the problem is no one's been able to get used to whoever's in there.
But also, there wasn't the proverbial dead cat on the table.
No.
You know, that's the whole idea, that if there's a scandal erupting, you chuck a dead cat table, go, oh, look, there's a dead cat on the table, it stinks, and everyone goes over there.
But unfortunately...
At no point do they ever try and change the conversation. Like, you've got to, like, you know, do something quite dramatic, but there was no attempt
to
do that.
But down the street itself was a giant, dead, stinking cat, wasn't it? The house itself.
Guys, on that salacious note, that's all we've got time for this week. Thank you very much indeed to Giles and Mick for joining me. But most of all, thanks to you for listening. Please join us next time. It'll be a scandal if you don't. Hacks and Flacks is presented by me, Petrie Hoskin, produced by Amanda Redman, and brought to you by Trafalgar Strategy. If you want to get in touch with your take on the current news climate, you can do that by emailing us at hackflackpod@gmail.com. And don't forget to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time on Hacks and Flacks.